the antenna to a point T in this illustration. And again, you know, I'm going, unfortunately, I'm going by an illustration here. Can't convey that any better than the way that I'm explaining this. But if you look in the antenna handbook, you will see this. And if you look it up, you do a Google search, you'll see how, this result occurs because of this. They go on to say a second signal path follows line Y. There's another line called Y, so there's X line and Y line. So there also could be a Z line, but they don't mention that. A second signal path follows line Y to the point of ground reflection and then up to a point T where it either adds or subtracts from the signal arriving for X and Y and the reflected part, which they call P, and how it adds or subtracts. Again, I'm just mentioning this just to convey the information of what the signal does when it leaves the vertical dipole. Not a horizontal, but a vertical. Alright, so it says actually the section is similar to the reflection of light by a mirror. And it is though an image antenna were present beneath the ground. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we have an image signal, but it looks like there's another antenna below the ground because of the reflected signal that's coming back from the ground. So it looks like, what it electrically looks like, and operates like the signal's coming from the ground, because it does, because it is bouncing from the ground and reflecting back up. The effect of the ground on the vertical radiation pattern of a horizontal dipole, now this is a horizontal dipole, is demonstrated in this particular figure. So now they're going to a horizontal dipole, not a vertical. A half wavelength horizontal antenna mounted a half wavelength above the ground has a vertical radiation pattern similar to that shown here in this figure 26. Again, it could be a little bit confusing because now they're jumping into a horizontal antenna pattern would look like as opposed to a vertical antenna. Alright, so they show a diagram here, and they say this is the end view of the antenna. It looks as though it were on the ground instead of a half wavelength above because of the small scale of this drawing. And the antenna, or I should say, if the antenna is mounted a quarter wavelength above the ground, it will still have the pattern similar to that shown in this particular figure when viewed from the end. So anybody wants to mount a vertical antenna, so just keep that in mind that you're going to have ground reflections which are going to add or subtract to the signal. That's the bottom line of this, as opposed to putting up a horizontal antenna where you're going to have your maximum direction broadside to the antenna and in whatever direction you mount the antenna. So vertical dipoles you don't hear too much about. Horizontal, yes, but you can mount it vertically. Alright. In fact, you can mount any antenna vertically, or horizontally, or any other angle you want. As long as it's resonant, it'll radiate, which is the basic fundamental of antennas. They just have to be resonant. And they'll radiate somewhere, in some direction, and you'll have a signal. Alright, so, hope I'm not boring too many people with these little discussions. We'll see. I think I have, what time is it? It's 9:10. Alright, I'm not going to go into the Marconi antenna, which is actually a vertical antenna itself. It's called the Marconi antenna. The antenna we're talking about, they originally called it a Hertz antenna, which is a horizontal dipole antenna. So, luckily, we don't have that much left to talk about with this, in this discussion, before we get into the Marconi, but I'm going to save that, because it could be a little bit too much at one time. Okay, so these illustrations, which they show here, show the influence of, this is the bottom line, the influence of the ground on the vertical radiation pattern of a vertical antenna mounted one-half wavelength above ground. Another figure shows the vertical radiation pattern of the antenna. Oh, they're just repeating that. Figure 27 shows the vertical radiation pattern of the antenna. Again, because of the scale of the drawing, the antenna looks like it was directly on the ground. This vertical radiation pattern is similar to that obtained from a halfway vertical antenna in free space. But the lobes are much narrower, and there is only half of each one. Again, that's because of where it's mounted and what the ground influence is doing. Alright, so this has quite a few little illustrations here. The antenna height above the ground has a decided influence on the vertical radiation pattern and must be considered in planning an antenna to provide maximum signal strength into a desired reception area. Furthermore, the ground reflections causes secondary current to flow in the receiving antenna, which can aid or reduce the original current. I'm using the word aid instead of add. So it could aid in the current or reduce the current, the original current of the antenna. They just added this in. So if you just, you know, to summarize, and this is the end of this discussion, because the next discussion will be on the Marconi antenna, which is a different antenna rather than a vertical dipole. If you take the dipole and just mount it vertically, above the ground is the real antenna at the quarter wavelength above the ground, but below the ground as a mirror image, you're going to have the imaginary antenna. So, and of course, as I said, that's going to influence the radiation pattern on your height above ground on a vertical antenna. So, and this is showing as a quarter wavelength above the ground, a quarter wavelength length of the antenna above and below, as I'm trying to explain this. All right, that's it for now for this short discussion. Again, Marconi antenna is next, and it's a little bit more, it's more diagrams in it, so I'm going to have to see if I can get into that. But we'll save that for next week. If anybody has any questions on this, just let me know or let Roy know. And hopefully you got a little bit of more insight on these, on horizontal and vertical dipole. That's it for now. Andy's Corner. Thank you. Back to you, Roy, WA2CDL.
Wesley recognized. You have a question for Andy?
Go to square.
Go ahead. I'll see if I can answer it, which makes sense.
Yeah, great lecture. Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. From the lecture that you gave to us, it looks like antennas should be raised high in order to antenna perform. And I strongly disagree with it, if that was the intention. Yes, I agree that we have imaginary part of the antenna beneath the ground that influence the overall impedance of or impedance matching of the antenna to the field line. However, we're talking about HF, which is mostly used by a lot of ham radio operators. We're dealing with ground waves and sky waves, and they are totally different. So my question to you is, do you agree with me doubting that antenna has to be raised right, high, and we should avoid ground wave propagation? Thank you.
Hello, It could be a controversial discussion as far as agreeing or disagreeing. You know, as the antenna handbook talks about this, and I'm not reading it from the antenna handbook, it'll explain in more depth why ground reflections occur in the first place and how it affects the impedance of the antenna. We know, and I know from experience, that an antenna in free space has a certain free space impedance. And as we know, in a dipole around 72 ohms or so, 70-something ohms, as you bring an object closer to it, the impedance goes down because of capacitance effects and so on. Same thing for the ground. Ground's going to affect the impedance. You know that. And of course, Dick has mentioned many times you want to keep the antenna, you know, a certain height above the ground because you don't want to heat up, the way he said it, you don't want to heat up the worms in the ground because you're wasting all that energy. You're directing a signal in a direction you don't want it to be. So ground has a definite influence on impedance and radiation and so on, and this basic discussion just explains that. So, you know, that's all I can say about it right now. If you want to do any further reading on it, you could look up some of the information. So bottom line, I'm not going to agree or disagree. I'm going to be nonpartisan because I'm not sure, you know, how you look at it, how you see this whole thing. Again, I'm just trying to convey this information, what I'm reading here. And I know this is trustworthy. All right, back to you, and I got to get going anyway because I do have to get ready for work tomorrow.
Thank you very much, and thank you. But there are certain advantages and disadvantages about skywave and ground wave. Skywave uses horizontal vertical polarized antennas and can be used in all HF bands. From 1.8 to 20 megahertz, but it's quite useful for 3.5 to 4, which is 80 meters band, and 7 megahertz. It is very much of use also at 14 megahertz, 14 to 1435. Ground wave, we may say that doesn't work well in the sharp terrain, such as ridges or deep valleys between stations, and the distance significantly attenuates the signal, requiring more power to get reliable communication at 80 and 160 meters. But when we go above that, ground wave is our base for communication. With the exception of 28 megahertz. So, and then we have antenna tuner, and we can tune properly the feed line, the transmitter to the antenna, to the feed line, to get a proper impedance match and wave to be propagated. And that usually is a 50 ohm, sometimes 75 ohm, like I remember Zeke was selling. Not important. It doesn't make a big difference. Okay. So, really, if we put the antenna low and we use the antenna tuner, we don't have the effect of the ground too much affecting our communication. I wonder what Dr. Roy would say about that. Andy is going out of the next internship.
I just want to say one more thing. An antenna is an antenna, and I think Roy will agree, an antenna is an antenna is an antenna. You could build an antenna at any frequency you want. You can go from zero cycles up to gigacycles, and many different designs and shapes and colors and so on of antennas can be designed. There's no... We're talking about a dipole antenna, of course. We're assuming it's for HF. It doesn't have to be. You could build a dipole antenna for this band. You could build a dipole for the 2-meter band. Like, they have dipoles for the 2-meter band. I think a J-pole... even our collinear antennas or, you know, dipole antennas that are matched, even your antenna on your vehicle, on your car, is a section of a dipole, if you want to look at it that way, that's got multiple dipoles connected together, which give you more gain, and so on. So, the reason I'm saying that, we're not limited to the frequencies that we assume that a dipole is being used. You can use a dipole for anything you want. Anyway, I just wanted to add that in. So, okay. Thanks, Leslie. We'll continue. Next week, we'll talk about the Marconi antenna, which you'll find interesting. Roy, back to you, and see you next week on the Andy's Corner, WATCDL.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. I really appreciate it, this episode. I look forward to next week's episode. For members of Limark, if you go back through back issues of the newsletter, the e-log, I have a bunch of articles on all matters of this topic with illustrations. I took out the antenna simulation software and ran these things through it to get flat images of three-dimensional aspects of the propagation. So for you people who pay the dues and get the newsletter, hopefully you'll take a look at the middle of the newsletter each month. Next newsletter, I have an article that's about loading a electronically short antenna and where to put it and what it does. So keep that in mind. As for Wesley's comment, I could put my 2 cents in. I think more than, say, calling it a ground wave antenna, most people tend to call it a near vertical incident sky wave. Usually these are things like horizontally polarized dipoles that are about the 1/4 of a wavelength or less from the ground. The idea being, as Andy mentioned, that the reflections have disruptive and constructive interference patterns and effectively change the distribution of the radio propagation from more to the sides, the horizons, to straight up, and it tends to bounce back, and that's what gives you a near vertical incident skyway. Generally, you have to be cautious with this because if you place the horizontal dipole too close to the ground, as also Andy mentioned, you get a lot of coupling. What effectively happens is a lot of that RF is just drained into the ground and reduced to waste heat. So you're getting a much less efficient near vertical incident sky wave as you bring it closer and closer to the ground, unless you're shielding it with some kind of a counterpoise or some insulating conducting material that the vertical antennas all have. So that's my 2 cents worth on ground wave antennas.
Thank you very much, and that's fantastic.
You're welcome, Wesley. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Limewark Technical Net, and we still have time for any kind of technical questions if you're so inclined. If we don't get any kind of useful technical questions, I have puzzles that I'd like to offer you people, and we can discuss other aspects of science and medicine, and of course I have some articles for Science Talk if we have time for that. But first, once again, if anyone else has come up with any kind of technical amateur radio related question or wants to comment on any aspect of what Andy presented tonight or something else, this is as good a time as any, so hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign.
Roy, this is Ed, K2GJE. I don't know if the fellow that's having boat anchor problems is still listening. It's a matter of divide and conquer. Over.
Sure, Ed. Do you have any words of wisdom? Hopefully Wayne is still out there and listening.
Hey, this is Ed, K2GJE. I assume it's an old boat anchor that has a transformer, probably some rectifier tubes, an input capacitor, a choke, and an output capacitor, and then the load of the rest of the equipment. Over.
As far as I can tell, that sounds a lot like it. It is a separate unit. It's connected to the radio by a 12-conductor power cord, but it will not power up unless the radio is turned on, even though the power is coming through it.
Well, probably what the radio has the on-off switch. The first thing is the power transformer. You have to isolate it by taking out the rectifier or rectifier tubes and then see what happens. Is it the transformer? If everything fires up good with the rectifier tube out, then you proceed further. You disconnect the load from the rectifier tube, which is probably a capacitor and a choke, and put the tube back, and then you see what happens. Over.
All right. I actually have four big filter capacitors, and a very large transformer, and also a smaller transformer next to it, all in the power supply.
I don't know what the smaller transformer is for. You really need a schematic. It may just be for the filament on the rectifier tube, or it may be for filaments in the equipment. But the first thing is pull out the tubes, the rectifier tubes, and when you turn it on, it's going to put power to the transformer. And then, do we have a transformer problem? If we do, well, you hit gold. And if you proceed by putting the rectifier tubes back and disconnecting the capacitor and choke, and then see what happens. And the best thing, probably, you can run it with all those electrolytics disconnected and see what happens. It's a divide and conquer. You just can't power it up and expect you're going to find a problem without disconnecting some of these components. Over.
Yeah,
can I break in for a sec?
That's what I was afraid of. I don't have all the I don't have an ESR tester to test the capacitors, and I was hoping it wasn't the transformer, because if it's that, then I think I'm dead on the water.
Hey, K2GJE, the test of the, well, you went out, tester for the capacitors, you must disconnect them. You must disconnect them. If they're bad, you'll find out with them out of the circuit. But you have to start just with that power transformer isolated. I don't know if it's just a power transformer for the high voltage and you have a separate transformer for filaments. You really need to look at the schematic, but you're going to have to do some cutting or unsoldering to find your power supply problem. And even if the power supply checks out, well, then it's the load on the power supply. It's a divide and conquer procedure. And even if it is the transformer, that there's so much now available on the internet, or even maybe Andy can help you with a transformer. Because I recently, probably about a year ago, I had a boat anchor where the transformer went bad. And unfortunately, any transformer I could find would not fit, so it's hanging outside the unit. That's my word of advice for tonight. This is K2GJE.
Hey, thank you, K2GJE. Thank you, Ed, I believe that's your name. This is KD2UDU, and I will take your advice and hopefully report back with some degree of success.
There's our solid-state rectifiers in the power supply. Is that correct, Wayne, that there's no vacuum tubes in the power supply?
Sorry, I keyed on part of you, Roy. No, there is a tube. There is at least one, possibly two tubes in the power supply. It's not solid-state. It's not a hybrid at all.
Okay, I get it wrong then. Okay, well, you know, I mean, Ed has some good advice. I mean, that's I think what pretty much Andy does when he does the technical repairs. He works logically through the system to figure out what might cause the problem. Although, yeah, Ed's right that the transformer might have shorted out. That's going to be a real pain in the backside. It would be a lot easier if one of the filtering capacitors shorted out. And as I mentioned before, you don't necessarily need an ESR meter. It would be nice, but you could probably budget with a volt ohmmeter that's capable of reading capacitance and just cutting one end of the capacitor lead, hooking it up to a volt ohmmeter that's capable of that, and trying to figure out what the capacitance is for that device, and you might be able to figure out that one of them is shorted out and such. So it's a possibility, but you know, also I would suggest that when Andy has a chance to talk to you, that you take his advice. He's a lot more practiced with this than I ever did. Yes, Ed, EAV. I can't just say Ed because people won't know if I'm talking to EAV or GJE. So what the words of wisdom can you lend us, Ed?
Lasting problem with resurrecting boat anchors is those can electrolytic capacitors have a lifetime. And if it's been sitting there for years, they may be bad, or they may need resolving by pushing up the unit to a variac, slowly building up the AC voltage. So I would look into that before I really was crazy.
Yeah,
okay, I mean, that's an idea. He already
tonight
bought a variac. I don't know if he slowly went up on the voltage to hopefully reform the electrolytic. That's an option. I know other people who just, before they even start working on a device, we'll just strip all the old electrolytic capacitors out of the unit and replace them with fresh new stock from a reputable company. So, I could certainly see that as some too. As GJE mentioned, a short in the transformer or a problem in the actual load. The cheapest solution is if it was hopefully just one of the electrolytic capacitors. So, if I was doing this, I would probably just stock up on the value of the electrolytic capacitors, swap them out, and then try once again. But we all have different ways of dealing with things.
There was a double roar. You
want to
did not hear what you said.
Okay, I said that Wayne has already bought a Variac and brought up the radio with a Variac. I'm not quite sure at what rate, if it was slow enough to reform old capacitors. But I also said that a lot of times some people just cut those capacitors, throw them in the garbage, and replace them. Because they are, as you mentioned, they have a limited lifespan, and you might be able to salvage it barely now, but in 6 months it may be completely useless. So if I was doing things, my guess would be I would end up with just replacing the electrolytic capacitors and the power supply and see what happens, because that's the cheapest solution. Anything else is going to be either more expensive or much more difficult to hunt down and get something that's guaranteed to work.
And the Voodoo double 2-1 Roy the first time, the second time was repetition. You never heard what Wayne said. Wayne, what did you say a minute ago?
Filling in what Roy had just said, I brought it up with a Variac, and then I took it off the Variac, and then the fuse started blowing. It's possible I didn't bring it up slow enough, as Roy said. We'll see, and I would agree. I would prefer if it was the capacitors, and that's kind of sound advice, Roy. Just go ahead and replace them, because they're 40-something years old already anyway, so that would be a good way to start. Hopefully it's not the transformer.
W-H-C-D-L for Wayne. I'm listening in the background.
Ed, Andy, I'm sorry. Did I key on you?
I just sent you my phone number via email. Could you call me? I sent you my phone. Just give me a call.
Andy, I have your phone number, but you want me to call you now?
Yeah, just give me a call now, okay? Because I'm working, but give me a call.
This is KD2UDU. I'm standing by for a landline.
You call me. I don't have your number. I don't know why. All right, thanks. W-H-C-D-L. Hello to Ed. I got to finish up here my paperwork. Go ahead, Roy.
Roy, what is the purpose of the Variac?
That application was clear, General.
And like I said before, please come back and tell us how this story ends, and thanks to GJE and EAV, my two Eds, my two wise gentlemen who have a lot to share with us all.
Roy, hang on. Leslie asked a fairly simple question. Leslie, you want to know the purpose of the area at that place or normal?
I've heard that the Variac was used. I'm just wondering what is the purpose of the Variac. If you know the voltage, the current grows up. The current grows up, the power equation is going to be the same. But now you likely blow the fuse. Because the fuse is the one that is rated with that. Thank you, actually.
In that application, the idea is those old tin can electrolytics and a wet electrolyte. And they do do great with time. Sometimes you can resurrect them by starting at 0 volts and bringing the voltage up 10 volts at a time over the period of several hours to reform the electrolytic. Not always, but if you don't do that, if you rush it, then the capacitor just breaks down. That's the purpose of the variac. So what I want to say is, slow process lasts a lot, several hours for it. By the way, back to you.
Thank you very much for the explanation.
Ken, let me pause for a second to make sure that I have the repeater. Okay, I don't want to double with anyone. Yeah, that's an old-fashioned way of doing things. Variacs are wonderful. They're auto-transformers, and you can boost up the voltage. There's also, to a secondary extent, in case there is a short, some people would prefer experiencing that at a low isolate the equipment. Because it's old equipment and parts of it can be hot. Because an auto transformer is not an isolation transformer and doesn't isolate anything. So that's the difference between using an isolation transformer when you're trying to fix and test things and a variac.
Oh, I just thought of something else, Roy.
KD2FIU.
Hang on, George. I only want 15 seconds, okay? Alright, listen everybody. One beauty of the modern transistorized rays is these boat anchors have voltages that can kill you. Be extremely careful. I'm done.
Okay, I completely agree with you. I think one of the great things about solid state equipment is the things that are designed primarily for 13.8 volts. You can electrocute yourself. You can kill yourself if you try hard enough, but it's much, 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 much more difficult. Whereas the old television sets and microwaves and the old boat anchors, it was rather easy to electrocute yourself. So I would agree with that as well. George, you wanted to say something, I assume, on the topic?
Thank you, Roy, KD2FIU, and yes, Ed, correct. You got to be careful of playing with voltages with the older radios and with the newer radios, but more extensively with the older radios. Getting back to the variac and the mains AC transformers in the older radios that need the variac to bring the radio up. Keep in mind, the mains AC transformers were designed for 6, 12, 18, 24, and 28 volt dissipations. The windings in those transformers are incredibly strong with output power, going back to what Ed just added there. Thank you, Ed, in front of it. But the whole thing is that the variac will bring up with AC, will bring those DC output voltages up very, very, very slowly. And that's what's going to stop the radio from sounding like you threw it into a garbage can with silver jets blowing off like fireworks if you haven't fired it up for 20 years. Or 30 years, or 40 years. So the idea is, with the variac, you're actually powering AC into that transformer for its winding changes to DC that are going to be of different voltage levels. Not every capacitor needs the same voltage level. Not every circuit needs the same voltage level. Not every tube needs the same voltage level. So the variac is going to say, let's transform what's coming out of there nice and easily. KD2FIU.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Yes, Leslie.
It's a great idea. Yeah, the problem that I have with that is I have an amplifier, and when I make the voltage lower than required, then the current grows. So it's supposed to be 13 volts, I make it lower. Or supposed to be 110 volts, because then it's going to the power supply. And the power supply is suitable for 110 volts, and I make it 100 volts. The current drops. So that makes the current increase. So you have a fuse in your radio. And you measure it in terms of power, and you put it into the equation. When the voltage is lower, the current grows, and the wattage is exactly the same. But then the fuse is going to blow. And then at a certain point, when you low voltage low enough, then it's cut off. It doesn't work. So the question is, what kind of power supply we're dealing with? Is it switching power supply? Is it a traditional power supply? And how that relates to that procedure of slowly raising the voltage. And to exit.
Wesley, my understanding is that this entire device is tubed and about 40 plus years old. So my best guess is this ain't nothing close to a switching power supply. It is your basic analog, linear power supply. So for the most part, my understanding of linear power supplies, you lower the input voltage, you lower the output voltage. It doesn't have any kind of voltage regulation circuit that I'm aware of, although the tube might act partially as that, but I would assume that as you crank up the input voltage via the variac, you'll increase the output voltage, and because the load characteristics are whatever they are, as you know, if that means that the current will increase with the voltage.
KD2FIU.
Is this for a transmitter or
a vehicle? George and Ed recognize this is a transceiver, I believe.
That supply is probably putting out 700 volts at about 100 to 200 milliamps.
It's always good to have the schematics and the service manual.
Probably got a pair of 6140 sensors in the output. They run around 700, 750 on the plate.
Okay. Again, I don't understand the problem with the variac. Variac, you know, I mean, true, if you're using modern-day fidgety electronics, it can do all kinds of things. If you give it a low enough amount of voltage, it can act erratically because, you know, CPUs will misbehave and all kinds of things. But I would assume something that was built 40, 50 years ago, you cut the voltage, you cut the current, you cut the wattage and such.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a damn tube radio. Of course, there's no regulation that's going to cause the current to go up when the voltage goes down. Please.
Well, let me comment on that.
KD2FIU standing by.
Yeah, I agree. There isn't going to be too much regulation going on with that. George wanted to make a point, and then we'll go back to Wes.
Yeah, the AC to DC voltage regulation that's going on, plus the entire current change that's going on, is coming out of the transformer. Most likely, the transformer itself is not the problem. The output of the transformer could provide maybe anywhere 4, 5, 6 to 8. The idea is to bring the AC voltage in very low. So the current draw into the transformer is not allowing for high DC voltages to go out, or the required DC voltages that are needed. So you don't blow the old types of capacitors. At this point, you have not turned on filament to the tubes. So that's not going to be an issue. The idea is to save the capacitors. The rectification coming out of, meaning DC voltage, of the transformer is controlled by the AC voltage coming in. That's simply the effect of it. KD2FIU.
Okay, George, but you sound like you're disagreeing with something I said. I basically said the same exact thing. And probably it's best to just say that it's the secondary output AC power, because transformers don't transform direct current. It simply steps up or steps down alternating current. It's only once it gets into the rectifier bridge that you're dealing with something like direct current. I hope we can agree on that.
Yes, we're talking about the value of the variac. I'm sorry, I thought that's what the topic is, Roy. I'll stand by.
Okay, no problem. Wesley, you wanted to respond?
The value is completely right. Excellent explanation. The only thing is that imagine that you have a load. Forget about the different voltages for the moment. Just for you have a load at X amount of ohms, purely resisted. And then you derive the voltage, you slowly increase the voltage. The load doesn't change, and the value of the load doesn't change, and the load is strong enough to withhold the power that is going through the load. While you're making the voltage lower, increasing the current, because the power wattage has to be the same. So in other words, the load is using the same power from the transformer, from the power supply, at any point. Whether it's 1 volt and 20 amps, or it's 10 volts and less than the current, or 100 volts and much lower current. Do you agree with that?
KD2FIU.
With a comment?
Okay, a whole bunch of people. Who was the last person who didn't give a call time?
AF2B did not give the call time.
Okay, George is recognized. There's another person who had a comment. I can't quite make out. It sounded like WA2VDH, but I might be wrong. But whoever you are, please ID again.
Yes, that was WA2 Victor David Henry.
Okay, well, it goes to show I have a decent ear for voices. What did you want to say, John?
I think Wesley is speaking of some kind of constant power process where he's saying that the power, total power, is staying constant. But this is not that kind of process. You take a resistor, more voltage, more current. Less voltage, less current. So they're both going to go up and down together. If you change the voltage, make it higher, the current's going to get higher. Change the voltage, make it lower, current's going to get lower. It's not a constant power process.
KD2FIU.
George recognized. I'll give you the floor in 1 second. I agree with you, John. Things are unfortunately complicated in the real world in addition to that. There is some variation in the resistance of electrical equipment especially the old ones, in that the resistance of a lot of components is related to how hot they get. So when you start something up like a vacuum tube, the heating element, at a low voltage, it'll have a lower resistance as it gets to its optimal voltage potential. It heats up and the resistance goes up. So the resistance of the load can vary with the different voltages, but as you point. Power devices, you know, where you increase the voltage and decrease the current and vice versa. So I agree with you on that, John. George, yes, you wanted to say something.
And yes, the last station that came in, well, I would agree with that. Absolutely. We're not talking about one circuit. We're talking about a transformer that is actually rectifying voltages to perform delivery of maybe 4 to 6, 4 to 8 different DC output supplies to anywhere from maybe 30 to 300 different circuits in some of the older radios. So you want to bring it up very, very slowly. The thing is, it's not one circuit that you're powering. Probably some of the most important ones are when you're looking at powering tubes and you have the filament voltage capacitors. Some of the stronger demanded capacitors, and their limiting capacitors that go along with them. So it's a combination of, it could be 20, 30, 40 to 300 different circuits with anywhere from 3 to 5 to 7 to 8 different voltages on DC levels that are required. You power into that very slowly with the AC before you're rectifying it. KD2FIU.
Okay, very good, George. Anyone else with any comments on this topic tonight? Yes, Wesley.
There is a certain misunderstanding of what I say. Currently, the voltage are two fundamental quantities of electricity. Voltage is the cause and the current is the effect. The voltage between two points is equal to the electrical potential difference between those points. It is actually electromotive force responsible for the movement of electrons, the electric currents to the circuit. A flow of electrons forced into the motion by the voltage and the current. So when I was talking about current and voltage being voltage that is delivered, which is the potential, and the current that is flowing, and we have a certain load on it, it is enough for you just guys to take your ammeter and a voltmeter and put it in front of your radio and deliver from the variac the voltage. Now what you're going to see is, while you lowering the voltage, the current is getting higher. That's all I was trying to say. But the waiting on the fuse on that radio is constant, it's not changing. It's a resistor. At a certain point, the current is too strong. And then the fuse is low. In which point I'm wrong, Dr. Roy?
I'm not sure who doubled, but someone doubled with you. So if the person who doubled has an actual call sign and a legitimate comment, please feel free.
This is Ed, AF2P. I do have a legitimate comment if I am making it into the repeater properly.
Ted, you are.
What I hear Wesley saying is not correct. With a fixed load, with no voltage regulation circuit, with a tube radio like we're talking about, if you increase the voltage, you increase the current. And we're talking about using a variac. The variac will raise the voltage as you turn it up. The circuit being fed will draw more current. That is where I believe you are saying something that is not correct. Now, maybe I'm not understanding you, Wesley, but you said, if you said something wrong, say it. That's what I think is wrong.
Okay, Wesley, you want to respond to Ed? Because I pretty much agree with Ed. As long as you, we don't play around with weird esoteric electronic design. Just meat and potatoes, transceivers from, 40, 50 years ago, I would agree with Ed. There's nothing particularly magical going on with those old machines.
Thanks, Gene. Well, we could go with 2-volt battery, 6-volt battery. We could go with right. And that would be the thing is that your video is not dynamic resistor, and when you want to skip the esoteric part of it, then that's what I'm talking, doesn't make a sense. And you're right. I suggest you guys simply do simple things. Put your voltmeter, put your ampmeter in front of your radio. I have right now in my lab the amplifier, let me go.
Mark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Okay. I have an amplifier that is working from 10 kHz to 20 MHz at somewhere about 200 watts. And I have an ampmeter and voltmeter connected to it. It requires for me to bring 110 volts. When I go below 110 volts, my current is growing up. When I'm going to 90 volts, my current grows up a few amps. And when I'm going lower with the voltage, simply cuts. So if you want to measure it and you want to then make a discussion next week, I would appreciate that. But other than that, Roy is right and your guy's right. And to XGN.
I have a response if no one else does.
You can't kind of test your power supply because it's your power amplifier. We don't know if it's a switching power supply, if it's a voltage regulator, if there are other safety features built into it. Foldovers, who knows? We're just kind of talking about the way that Wayne KD2UDU presented his radio. It's a 40-plus-year-old vacuum tube boat anchor radio. And so that's what we're going on, and I'm glad you, in the end, agreed with us, as, at least along the lines of what we've been talking about.
There was a gentleman who wanted to make a response.
That's the same thing that I was going to say.
Tony B2GX.
Yes, Rich, you want to make a comment?
I'd like to know, can the variac procedure be used with solid-state equipment that has a linear power supply, or will it damage the solid-state electronics?